1968 AD, a year in the life of man. A time to be born, and a time to die. A time to weep, and a time to laugh. A time to mourn, and a time to dance. A time to keep silence, and a time to speak. 1968 AD, a year in the life of man.
The historians will put it down in day-by-day detail with footnotes on what, by then, may seem trivial. Those born in this time will read about it. The newsmen and women who cover the events will never forget. Those who lived through the time will remember when they wept, when they mourned, when they laughed, when they kept silent, and when they spoke out.
Give us, O God, the vision which can see thy love in the world in spite of human failure. Give us the faith to trust in goodness in spite of our ignorance and weakness. Give us the knowledge that we may continue to pray with understanding hearts. And show us what each one of us can do to set forward the coming of the day of universal peace. Amen.
That prayer was sent to Earth from Apollo as three American spacemen rode their steel chariot around the moon. Apollo, the ancient Greek god of sunlight, prophecy, music, and poetry, the past and the present, living together in the minds of man. 1968 was the year of Apollo, the presidential campaign, assassinations, the Pueblo crisis, war, and the talk of peace. The year got underway in January with a talk of politics. Senator Eugene McCarthy, liberal Democrat from Minnesota, was the first to lay down the challenge. And he was the man Lyndon Johnson almost picked as his running mate in 1964. On January 3rd, McCarthy told the nation he was seeking the Democratic presidential nomination, would run in the first in the nation primary in New Hampshire. And run he did, making student political power a household word for the year of 1968. What McCarthy started in the snows of New Hampshire was the beginning of the most dramatic and tumultuous political year in American history. In space, the Moonlander was the year's first launch, called Surveyor 7. It dropped onto the lunar surface near the crater Tycho on January 9th, ending the highly successful series of Surveyor soft landers. Scientists used its television eye, its digging claw, and its remote control chemistry lab to help analyze the lunar surface. Among the first 18 unmanned flights of the year, the space agency logged only three failures. One of the top news stories of the year happened on January 23rd. A U.S. Navy ship loaded with electronic surveillance equipment, the Pueblo, was cruising off North Korea. She was boarded by four North Korean patrol boats and forced into the port of Wonsan. North Korea claimed the Pueblo was in her territorial waters, but Washington denied it. The Reds held on to the crewmen and the vessel, and diplomatic negotiations were started in Panmunjom. No progress was made. The wife of the ship's commander made a statement.
My purpose in appearing here today is to urge your support, indeed your leadership, in reminding the leaders of this great country that they have apparently abandoned the crew of the USS Pueblo and have allowed our nation's honor to be questioned as never before in history.
Then the Pueblo crisis was overshadowed by news of treachery in Southeast Asia. The Viet Cong called for a ceasefire during Tet, the Buddhist New Year period. But Tet is no holiday. The VC break that ceasefire and launch what is to become known as the Tet Offensive. The communists strike at the cities and hamlets, try to storm the U.S. Embassy in Saigon, lay siege to the northern city of Hue. Thousands of Vietnamese civilians are killed. The fighting is vicious. U.S. Marines blasting out the Viet Cong house by house in Hue. Fighting similar to the city battles in Germany in the final days of World War II. Observers believe the communists staged the offensive to strengthen their hand at any peace conference. Washington says the Tet Offensive is a military failure. The Viet Cong failed to hold Hue, failed to take any major city. On February 4th, the communists launch an all-out attack against Khe Sanh. The toll of U.S. Marines is heartbreaking, but the Leathernecks hold. And by April 6th, the siege of Khe Sanh is lifted. The bombing of the North continued, and the president was under constant pressure at home and abroad to halt the bombing as a step toward getting peace talks started. In the U.S., the nation had its first statewide teacher strike in February when 40% of Florida's teachers left their jobs. There were also teacher strikes in New York City, San Francisco, Pittsburgh, and other cities. Students demonstrated violently at many colleges, the worst coming at Columbia in New York City. Hundreds arrested, hundreds injured, and the school shut down. Also in the spring, France is rocked by student rioting, street battles in Paris, the nation paralyzed by strikes. Charles de Gaulle calls for a referendum, promises to resign if he loses, but de Gaulle wins. Politics made the news again in February. Richard Nixon said he would go for the Republican presidential nomination. That was expected. But there were other prominent Republicans who also thought it would be a good year to go for it. Michigan Governor George Romney said he was in and did some campaigning for the New Hampshire primary. But then on February 28th, said he was out. On February 24th, New York Governor Nelson Rockefeller said he's not actively after it, but would accept a draft. California Governor Ronald Reagan also making sounds and trips as if he were a candidate. It was Saturday, March 16th. 42-year-old Robert Kennedy, with wife Ethel and several of his 10 children at his side, announces he is an active candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination. There had been pressure on Kennedy to run, his backers wanting the return of Camelot. The Democratic Party was in for a real old-fashioned Donnybrook. Two popular Democratic senators, each with a large following, are challenging a powerful president for the nomination. Most political experts are saying they don't have a chance, that President Johnson is sure to want the nomination, that his party will hand it to him on a unanimous platter. Then came March 31st, and Lyndon Johnson's political bombshell.
I do not believe that I should devote an hour or a day of my time to any personal partisan causes or to any duties other than the awesome duties of this office, the presidency of your country. Accordingly, I shall not seek and I will not accept the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
The nation was shocked. One early reaction came from Senator Eugene McCarthy.
I really have no comment on it, excepting to say that it is a surprise and that it changes the political picture in America for 1968. Now, that's what that says.
Standing in the wings during that presidential speech was Hubert Horatio Humphrey, vice president, former Minnesota senator, liberal, but under increasing criticism for his hawkish stand on the war. It is assumed that Humphrey will now go to the post and, with LBJ's blessings, challenge McCarthy and Kennedy. On Saturday, April 27th, Humphrey made his move. He says, "I intend to fight hard and clean for the nomination, but I do not intend to divide the party or the nation." But this was not going to be any typical presidential battle between Democrat and Republican. This also was to be the year of George Wallace, former Alabama governor. Wallace forms the American Independent Party, gets his name on the ballot in all 50 states. And as spring moves into summer, the polls show him with surprising strength. The battle lines were drawn. The original intent of that Johnson speech on March 31st was almost forgotten. No strikes above the 20th parallel. On April 3rd, Washington and Hanoi agree to establish contact to try to get the talks started. A hassle develops over a conference site. The U.S. wants a neutral site. The communists prefer Paris.
I have sent a message informing Hanoi that the date of May the 10th and the site of Paris are acceptable to the United States. We hope that disagreement on initial contact will prove a step forward and can represent a mutual and a serious movement by all parties toward peace in Southeast Asia.
The talks did get underway on May 3rd. These are not peace talks. This is only talk on how to get down to the real business at hand. A terrifying word crops up again in 1968. Assassination.
I don't really fear in the sense that I worry and I have what I would call abnormal fears. I have what I would consider realistic concerns. It's a reality we have to live with, that every day of his life, something could happen.
Those were the words of Mrs. Martin Luther King. Something could happen. and did. King, the civil rights leader, the Nobel Prize winner, is in Memphis to lead a march in support of striking garbage workers. He is staying at a place called the Lorraine Hotel. Only that day, King made this speech.
We've got to give ourselves to this struggle until the end. Nothing would be more tragic than to stop at this point in Memphis. We've got to see it through.
That same evening, King steps out onto the balcony of his hotel for some fresh air. There are some friends standing in the parking lot, and there's cheerful banter. It's chilly. Someone suggests that King put on some kind of wrap. He agrees and turns to leave. In an instant, he lies dying on the balcony. An ambulance arrives, and King was rushed to the hospital, but it was too late. The most respected civil rights leader in the nation is dead. His assassin has escaped. That shot touches off a wildness that shakes the nation for days to come. President Johnson cancels a trip to Honolulu for meetings on Vietnam and makes a plea to the people of the U.S.
I ask every citizen to reject the blind violence that has struck Dr. King, who lived by nonviolence.
Despite that plea, Negro riots break out in Washington, Chicago, Baltimore, and many other cities. Fires, sniping, looting. It takes federal troops to put it down in many areas. And by the weekend, the world has a picture of Army machine gun emplacements on the steps of the Capitol in Washington. On April 9th, Martin Luther King Jr. is taken to his final resting place in Atlanta. An African mahogany coffin on a farm wagon pulled through the streets by mules. Some 100,000 are there to watch, to march along, and to sing the old hymns. Vice President Hubert Humphrey is there, and Mrs. John F. Kennedy, Richard Nixon, Governor Nelson Rockefeller, and Senator Robert Kennedy.
No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero.
The great and the common people who believed in what Martin Luther King was trying to do. Presidential politics is forgotten for a time. It was a time for soul-searching. An assassin had taken a president less than 5 years ago. Now another assassin had taken a renowned leader. Martin Luther King was mourned. The hunt for his assassin went on, and Mrs. King returned to Memphis.
How long will it take? How many men must die before we can really have a free and true and peaceful society?
Tragedy struck again in May. The United States Navy suffering one of its worst peacetime disasters. The announcement was made on May 27th.
The nuclear attack submarine, USS Scorpion, has been reported overdue at Norfolk, and units of the Atlantic Fleet have begun a search by submarines, surface ships, and aircraft. She is commanded by Commander Francis A. Slattery of Virginia Beach, Virginia, and carries a ship's company of 99 officers and men.
Later in the year, that loss was confirmed. Parts of the Scorpion hull were found off the Azores Island on October 31st. The big drive for votes went on throughout May and into the month of June. Robert Kennedy won in Indiana and Washington, D.C., then took Nebraska. Next was Oregon. He stumbled. McCarthy won it and was still very much in the race with California next. The pros said the winner in California would be a real challenge to Hubert Humphrey in Chicago. Robert Kennedy blitzed the state from one end to the other, some days making as many as 15 speeches. He was mobbed almost everywhere he stopped. And as Election Day, June 4th, neared, there was the smell of victory in the Kennedy camp. On Election Day, Kennedy set up his headquarters in a suite of rooms on the fifth floor of the Ambassador Hotel in Los Angeles. Downstairs in the embassy ballroom, hundreds of his supporters watched the returns, waved their Kennedy straw hats and signs, and cheered. As the evening wore on, it became apparent that Robert Kennedy would be the winner. At midnight, it was definite. The returns were piling up toward at least a 46% for Kennedy, 42% for McCarthy. Kennedy, his wife Ethel, and his key aides went downstairs to the embassy ballroom. Robert Kennedy made his victory speech and ended with these words, "I think we can end the divisions within the United States. What I think is quite clear is that we can work together. We are a great country, a selfless and a compassionate country." The crush in the ballroom was too great for Kennedy to exit that way. It was decided to exit through a back pantry. He was smiling, shaking hands with the kitchen help. Ethel was separated from him in the crush of people in the small room. A short young man edged close to Kennedy. He was only about a foot away when he opened up with an M-22 caliber revolver. A Mutual newsman, Andrew West, was near Kennedy through the entire ordeal. West asked Kennedy a question, which you will hear, and then stopped the recorder. You will then hear a swishing sound about 30 seconds into the tape where West restarted his recorder. Listen very closely. First, Robert Kennedy.
My thanks to all of you, and now it's on to Chicago, and let's win there.
To counter Mr. Humphreys and his backgrounding you as far as the delegate votes go.
You can just go and start your struggle for it.
Senator Kennedy has been shot. Is that possible? Is that possible? It could. Is it possible, ladies and gentlemen? It is possible. He has. Not only Senator Kennedy. Oh, my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot. And another man, a Kennedy campaign manager, and possibly shot in the head. I am right here. Rafer Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. He has fired the shot. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me right at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun. Stay away from the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Get his thumb.
In his
hand. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. Now look. Get away from the barrel. Get away from the barrel, man.
Watch the gun.
Look out for the gun. Okay. All right. That's it, Rafer. Get it. Get the gun, Rafer. Okay, now hold on to the guy. Hold on to him. Hold on to him, ladies and gentlemen. They have the gun away from the man. In this shot. They've got the gun. I can't see the man. I can't see who it is. But Senator Kennedy right now is on the ground. He has been shot. This is... What is he? Wait a minute. Hold him. We don't want another Oswald. Hold him, Rafer. We don't want another Oswald. Hold him, Rafer. Keep people away from him. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is it. Now, make room. The senator is on the ground. He's bleeding profusely. Apparently, the senator has been shot from the... in the frontal area. We can't see exactly where the senator has been shot. Ethel Kennedy is standing by. She is calm. She's raising her hand high to motion people back. She's attempting to get calm. A woman with a tremendous amount of presence. It's impossible to believe this.
Kennedy is rushed to one hospital for emergency treatment, then to another Good Samaritan for brain surgery. The Kennedy family gathers at the hospital. Wednesday seems endless. Each word from Good Samaritan is blacker and blacker. The surgery reveals that one of the two bullets that hit Kennedy shattered his brain. At 2 a.m. Thursday morning, Kennedy's news secretary, Frank Mankiewicz, goes before the newsmen and says,
"Senator Robert Francis Kennedy died at 1:44 a.m. today, June 6, 1968.
An Arab immigrant, Saran Saran, seized on the spot and later charged with Kennedy's murder. Then began the long final journey of Robert Francis Kennedy, dead at 42. President Johnson sent a presidential jet to Los Angeles to bring Robert Kennedy home to New York. His family, his older children, the men who labored with him through 81 days of campaigning, all were on the plane. So was Coretta King, who flew to Los Angeles to comfort Ethel Kennedy, as Ethel had comforted her in April. His coffin was placed in the center aisle before the great high altar of St. Patrick's Cathedral. The great doors of the cathedral were swung open to the public at dawn on that steaming hot Friday, and the people came to say goodbye to Bobby. The line stretched over 25 blocks of Midtown Manhattan, and the people came, young and old, businessmen and laborers, black and white, and the children. Many wept, and almost all reached out to gently touch the flag-draped coffin. Over 100,000 came through the day and into the night until the cathedral doors were finally closed early Saturday morning to prepare for the funeral mass. It was an assemblage of the great from all walks of life, the president, the chief justice, the cabinet, the men seeking the presidency, and the men of the new frontier who now had lost another leader. A high requiem mass and then a eulogy by Edward Kennedy.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Then Robert Kennedy's coffin is borne through the streets of Manhattan to Pennsylvania Station and placed aboard a 21-car funeral train for the journey to Washington. The journey takes 9 hours. The train moves very slowly because hundreds of thousands line the 226-mile route to wave farewell. And the journey is marred by tragedy. A man and a woman at Elizabeth, New Jersey, stray too close to the tracks and are hit and killed by a northbound train.
All hell broke loose. This thing rode through Elizabeth with the horns blaring. It didn't slow down one lousy second. That man didn't take that train into a brake condition. He went clear through the station. This train barreled through. I want to tell you, it didn't slow down one iota.
The funeral train is stopped. The Kennedy family asks that all rail traffic between New York and Washington be stopped. It is. Slowly, cautiously, the funeral train begins to move. And the man who once said that life is like playing Russian roulette resumes his final journey. Bobby's mother, Rose Kennedy, reassured the nation.
We cannot always understand the ways of Almighty God. The crosses which he sends us. The sacrifices which he demands of us. But we know his great goodness and his love. And we go on our way with no regrets for the past, not looking backwards to the past, but we shall carry on with courage.
Even as Robert Kennedy's body was being gently lifted down the steps of St. Patrick's Cathedral on that dreary June 8th, there was important news from London. James Earl Ray, alias Eric Starvel Galt, had been arrested by immigration officials at Heathrow Airport on a phony passport charge. The news spread like wildfire through Resurrection City in Washington, D.C. But for a senseless, wanton act only 61 days before, Martin Luther King would have been at Resurrection City that day, guiding the poor people's crusade he had so long planned. But that march was not without leaders. The day was June 19th.
Years ago that my late husband, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., stood in this very spot and told the nation about his dream.
And also at that Poor People's Crusade in Washington, D.C., this speech by Ralph Abernathy.
We will be here in Washington
until the Congress of the United States and the leaders of the various departments of our government decide that they are going to do something about the plight of poor people in this country.
Negroes became more and more militant in their demands for equal rights. There were riots, not as many as in the past, but some of them were violent. In June, Cleveland saw what was believed to be the first organized Negro ambush against police. And more as the year went on, Negroes seemed more determined to advance on their own, without help from whites, and often with outright rejection of white help. It was only July in this incredible year. Lyndon Johnson out of the race, Martin Luther King assassinated, Robert Kennedy assassinated, moves toward possible peace in Vietnam. But this was a year historians would long record. Now it was McCarthy and Humphrey fighting for the Democratic nomination. Now it was Richard Nixon with it apparently locked up. There's Ronald Reagan saying he still wants it. There's Nelson Rockefeller saying he'll still take it. But now it's Miami Beach at the night of August 8th. And Senator Everett Dirksen brings the party together.
I accept the nomination. Delegates and fellow citizens, I'm going to make you a little deal tonight. Here are the speeches. Now, if you will be quiet for 45 minutes, I'll throw these speeches any place you want me to throw them.
There's consternation in some quarters with a change in the GOP from hawk to dovish. General Eisenhower, still in Walter Reed Medical Center in the nation's capital, remonstrated with the party.
It is one thing to call for a peaceful settlement of this struggle. It is quite another to call for retreat by America. The latter is the best way I know to stockpile tragedy for our children. This we are resolved to prevent.
Richard Milhouse Nixon gets his party's nomination on the first ballot.
Madam Chairman, Wisconsin is proud to cast its 30 votes for the nominee of this convention, Richard M. Nixon.
The next morning, he picks his running mate. It's a complete surprise. Spiro Agnew, governor of Maryland.
I stand here with a deep sense of the improbability of this moment. Last night, when I faced these microphones to place in nomination one of the truly great Americans of our time, Richard M. Nixon, I honestly had no idea whatsoever that I would be back on this platform to accept this nomination tonight.
Spiro Agnew, almost unknown, and there is criticism. The nation is assassination nervous. This man would be a heartbeat away from the most powerful office in the world if Nixon is elected. During the convention, there was Negro rioting in the city of Miami, and at least four persons were killed. Next, the Democrats. The place, Chicago, fear hangs over this one. Anti-war demonstrators, anti-establishment, anti-Humphrey Johnson groups threaten to break apart this convention. There's a communication strike that threatens to disrupt news coverage. But the powerful Democratic mayor of Chicago, Richard J. Daley, is determined that his city will host the convention, and he prevails. It's going to be a battle between the old pros and labor leaders supporting Hubert Humphrey and the young rebels wanting McCarthy. The question, where will the RFK people go? The charges and countercharges before convention come down to soft and hard on Vietnam, on the Cold War in general.
History will judge this nation and this convention, in my view, harshly. If we fail to act or contribute in any manner that we may to the prolongation of this war or its escalation.
Representative Burton of California, it's August 21st, a week before the convention. Democrats are trying to place together a platform. It's mid-evening in America, and across the news teletype machines comes the bulletin. Russian and other Warsaw Pact forces have invaded Czechoslovakia. Those were the sounds of Russian tanks rolling into Prague. Czechoslovakia, taken over by Russia at the end of World War II, had become too liberal. Czech Communist Party leader Alexander Dubček was giving his people more freedom than the leaders in the Kremlin could allow. So the tanks and the troops rolled into the little nation. There was some brave resistance. Mary Nemec, a freelance reporter, was there.
Every time a crowd of more than 15 would gather,
The Russians would shoot into the crowd or above the heads or all around them. There is a Czechoslovakian man. He saved my life. I couldn't tell you how many times during the day. He had a sixth sense of knowing when the machine gun was going to start going rat-a-tat-tat, and he would throw me down on the ground and cover my body with his. And he said, you must take the story back. And people would come up and just with tears streaming down their face, hold on to us. They kept saying, you must help. You will help. We believe in the American Union, they said, as the mightiest force in the world.
But the point was made. A little country like Czechoslovakia does not fight a war machine spearheaded by the Soviet Army. The UN Security Council met. The leaders of the free world denounced. Czech leaders met with Russian leaders. But the results were a foregone conclusion when the tanks rolled and the troops marched. Czech reforms were ended. Monday, August 26th, the Democratic Party opened its convention in Chicago's International Amphitheater. Hubert Humphrey was the front runner. McCarthy still had some hope. A late entry was Senator George McGovern from South Dakota, and to him came many of Robert Kennedy's people. There were verbal battles on the convention floor that week over the seating of delegations, over the party platform on Vietnam. There was a dove plank denouncing the president's Vietnam policy, a hawk plank supporting his policy. The words were bitter, but in the end, the delegates supported the president. A victory for Humphrey. The bitter words in the huge old amphitheater on the city's south side, close by the stockyards, were nothing compared to the bitter physical violence in the streets. So-called yippies and hippies and just plain dissenters had flocked into the city, settled down in the parks, and asked permission to march in convention hall to show their opposition to the war. Richard Daley said no. The governor ordered 5,600 National Guardsmen into the city, and regular army troops were stationed outside Chicago. The stage was set. The demonstrations began the Sunday night before the convention opened. Police moved the protesters out of the parks with swinging nightsticks. But night after night, the youths tried to march and were beaten back. Newsmen were clubbed as they took pictures. Convention delegates who tried to join the demonstrators got the same treatment. On Wednesday night, August 28th, the worst came as Hubert Humphrey was being nominated on the first ballot. Thousands of youths were massed in Grant Park across the street from convention headquarters, the Conrad Hilton Hotel, and trouble within the hotel.
The police received reports of objects being thrown out of a 15th floor window at the Conrad Hilton Hotel. Beer cans in paper bags, ashtrays, smoked fish, pennies, press badges. The police and the hotel security went up to the 15th floor after pinpointing the rooms from across the street and found about 75 young people, some drinking beer and a lot of beer cans around.
Demonstrators also tried to start a march. Police and guardsmen moved into action. The screams and the bloodshed were seen across the nation on television and brought stand-up shouting anger from many delegates in the amphitheater 6 miles away from the street battle. Hubert Humphrey has his party's nomination.
And so, my friends and fellow Americans, facing and knowing the hard realities of the office, yet also knowing the potential for good which lies within it, I shall seek the nomination of the Democratic Party.
The next morning, he picks Maine Senator Edmund Muskie to be his running mate. They receive the support of most of their party. George McGovern says he'll go all the way for the ticket. Edward Kennedy, who stopped the Draft Kennedy movement, will be for the ticket. But McCarthy holds back. The streets of Chicago are fairly quiet that night. The National Guard trucks and jeeps are moving out. The police are stowing away their robin egg blue riot helmets. The youths are rolling up their duffel bags. The delegates are checking out of their hotels. The Democrats are wondering what Chicago did to them. The day was October 11th, 1968.
5, 4, ignition. A soft and clutch starter, lift off. Clear the car. Roll commence. Hitch is tracking good. Roger. 5,005 degrees. Roll complete.
Voices of the astronauts.
Apollo 7 blasting into Earth orbit atop a Saturn 1 rocket, little brother of the Saturn 5. High points of that mission include the first live U.S. television shows from space, shows in which Wally Schirra, Don Isley, and Walt Cunningham were alternately hilarious and instructive. There was also a space chase and rendezvous with a Saturn I rocket and an upside-down landing in the Atlantic Ocean. Some bad moments cropped up during Apollo 7, too. Moments like the time the alternating current electricity popped off and the lights went off briefly. Moments like the ones when Shira, suffering from a bad cold, snapped at Earthbound flight controllers because of requests he considered unreasonable. But the flight taken as a whole was judged the most successful manned space mission the U.S. has ever flown. It was, said the chief of the Apollo program, a 100% success. And it cleared the way for Apollo 8 to fly around the moon. On October 20th, Jacqueline Kennedy, the widow of the assassinated president, married Aristotle Onassis, a Greek shipping tycoon. The Greek Orthodox ceremony took place on the Greek island of Scorpios. She is 39, he is 62, and had been divorced. The wedding touched off controversy because she is a Roman Catholic and married outside her faith. The Roman Catholic Church itself in turmoil, mainly over Pope Paul's ruling against the use of artificial birth control. Priests in America and many other nations denounced the ruling, with many advising that it did not have to be obeyed. As in all years, it was a time of violent death from the elements and man-made machines. Some of the worst, 12,000 dead in earthquakes in Iran, over 300 killed by quakes in Sicily. Hundreds die in Manila quakes. A South African Airways jet crash killed 122. An Air France crash in the Mediterranean took 95. A British airliner went down on a West German highway, 48 dead. An Air France plane went into the Guadalupe Mountains, 62 perished. 78 miners killed in explosions and fires at Mannington, West Virginia. In Richmond, Indiana, an explosion on an April afternoon left 43 dead. This was also the year for free trips to Cuba. 22 airliners seized at gunpoint and forced to fly to Havana. No one hurt. The planes and passengers were all returned, the hijackers apparently still somewhere down south. Heart transplants, which began December 3, 1967, approached the 100 mark at year's end, and it was estimated about 40 persons around the world are living on borrowed hearts. 1968 A.D., a year of war, and then on October 31st, a momentous announcement.
I have now ordered that all air, naval, and artillery bombardment of North Vietnam cease as of 8 a.m. Washington time, Friday morning. I have reached this decision on the basis of the developments in the Paris talks. And I've reached it in the belief that this action can lead to progress toward a peaceful settlement of the Vietnamese war.
A brief and temporary silence fell along the DMZ in Vietnam. No American jets flew north to blast military and industrial targets. No warships slammed salvos ashore. No land-based artillery fired into North Vietnam. It was the 10th bombing halt called by the president since aerial bombardment of the North began in early 1965. Since March 31st, however, when Johnson paired a restriction on bombing with the announcement that he would not seek another term as president, American flyers had been striking only a strictly defined area below the 19th parallel. The bombing restriction was aimed at getting the North Vietnamese to the conference table for preliminary talks. And the total halt at breaking the logjam of differences at the Paris talks and moving into full-scale peace negotiations. After conferences in Washington with General Creighton Abrams, who had replaced General W.C. Westmoreland, Johnson made his dramatic announcement and said that both Saigon and the NLF would be present at full-scale talks. It was made clear by administration spokesmen, however, that the NLF would be merely a presence, not a recognized government. The North Vietnamese could treat Saigon in the same light. As the year ended, Washington, Hanoi, and Saigon, along with the National Liberation Front, stuck to firmly stated conditions and demands. No end to the long war appears in sight. Across the USA go the candidates from September to the first week of November. Humphrey running into wild anti-war demonstrators. Nixon drawing large and enthusiastic crowds in traditional Democratic strongholds. George Wallace, now with General Curtis LeMay as a running mate, showing surprising strength. The fear? Wallace will pull enough votes to throw the election to the House of Representatives. Nixon is a way ahead in the polls. For Humphrey, it looks like a disaster. But late polls show him picking up strength. show Democrats who were leaning toward Wallace now coming back into the fold. The timing of President Johnson's bombing halt is questioned, but Humphrey's chances shoot up. Final pre-election polls show it will be a cliffhanger, and a cliffhanger it was. Through the night of November 5th it went. The computers couldn't call it. The commentators would not call it. First one in the lead, then the other. The only thing obvious, George Wallace was not getting the vote some experts said he would. Americans went to bed not knowing who the next president would be. At 11:25 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, Wednesday, November 6th, Richard Nixon was declared the apparent winner in Illinois and of the presidency. At 12:03 p.m., Humphrey went before cameras and microphones in a Minneapolis hotel and conceded defeat.
I have done my best. I have lost. Mr. Nixon has won. The democratic process has worked its will. So now let's get on with the urgent task of uniting our country. Thank you.
That election was so close in popular vote that President-elect Nixon declared his would be an open administration.
This will be an open administration, open to new ideas, open to men and women of both parties, open to the critics as well as those who support us. We want to bring America together, and I am confident that this task is one that we can undertake and one in which we will be successful.
For George Wallace and the American Independent Party, thoughts of the future. The
party is there, and it's ready, and we have many dedicated supporters, and in our judgment, the movement is here to stay. But now what form, we'll have to wait and see and play it by ear.
The final margin was Nixon by 505,488 votes. Electoral College, Nixon 302, Humphrey 191. George Wallace got 9,706,141 votes, Electoral College 45. By any standards, an election year to remember. The day was December 22nd, 1968, 11 months since the North Koreans had seized the Pueblo. Negotiations for the crew's release throughout the year had been futile. Then from the State Department, this announcement.
A meeting was held at Panmunjom last night. The crew of the Pueblo is scheduled to be released at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, December 22. Until then, we will have nothing more to say.
Major General Gilbert Woodward signed a confession to secure the release of the Pueblo crewmen. Before signing, General Woodward had this comment.
The document which I am going to sign was prepared by the North Korean and is at variance with the above position. But my signature will not and cannot alter the fact. I will sign the document to free the crew and only to free the crew.
The 82 surviving crewmen of the Pueblo were reunited with their families. The 83rd was killed by the captors while he was trying to destroy secret papers on board the ship. Just after the crew's release, Commander Lloyd Bucher, skipper of the captured vessel, talked with the press.
Were the members of your crew physically mistreated?
Yes, sir. They were beaten on several occasions.
Commander, we heard that there was a man beaten just yesterday or the day before, very recently.
Anything to that? Last week, several members of my crew, including myself, was beaten.
What form was it, sir? How did they beat?
Physically, with fists, generally. With boards and clubs at other times.
Commander Lloyd Bucher telling of mistreatment of the crew by the North Koreans. During their 11 months of imprisonment, he said the men were beaten and tortured. The question never answered thoroughly for some was whether the ship had been seized illegally. The United States maintains that the Pueblo was in international waters. This was a direct refutation to the Korean statement that they seized the ship only because it encroached their water boundary lines, which begin 12 miles off the shore of North Korea. But the navigational officer of the Pueblo disclosed that he fabricated charts to foil a communist attempt to make it appear that the intelligence ship was captured inside the zone. The officer said that the ship was well outside North Korea's territorial waters when it was seized, but he said that he inserted errors in the charts to make it obvious that they were false. The crew is back, but the ship remains in the hands of the North Koreans. At least one member of Congress has suggested going into North Korea and blowing up the ship, and another says it's a small price to pay for the safe return of the crew. So for all but one of the crew of the Pueblo and their families, 1968 was a tormenting year, but a year that ended with a joyful reunion the day before Christmas. December of 1968 A.D. was an incredible month in the year of Apollo.
10, 9, we have ignition sequence start. The engines are on. 4, 3.
She's building
two,
up and you can see
one,
the fire.
0. Coming out. We have commit.
We have liftoff.
We have liftoff. Liftoff at 7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time.
She's clearing the tower now on the
brink.
We're clear
tower
the
hour.
Plane. We're getting the shaking. Tremendous blast is hitting us now. She's going straight. She's in the roll program. She's looking good. A bright sapphire flame. 7.5 million pounds. They're on their way.
7:51 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, December 21st, 1968. The Apollo 8 had blasted off for a Christmas rendezvous with the moon. 12 months ago, no one would have dared predict this milestone in the history of man. Astronauts Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders are on their way.
Apollo 8, Houston. Go ahead, Houston. Apollo 8, you are go for TLI, over.
Roger, understand. We're go for TLI.
That was the okay for the translunar insertion. That change boosted the astronauts on their way to the moon. And then, on December 24th, they arrived at their destination.
The craters are all rounded off. There's quite a few of them. Some are newer. Many of them look like, especially the round ones, look like hit by meteorites or projectiles of some sort. The walls of the crater are terraced, about 6 or 7 different terraces on the way down.
Live television pictures of the moon were phenomenal, almost unbelievable down here on Earth. The ghostly orb 250,000 miles away is no longer the exclusive object of romantic earthbound poets, lovers, and other moon watchers. It's now in the grasp of the American spaceman. 10 orbits, and then back to Earth. Then came one of the most dramatic moments of the reentry.
This is Apollo Control, Houston. 146 hours, 58 minutes, recovery 2. Within the last minute, as reported, they have a flashing light in sight, and they followed that with, we have voice contact with the crew. I repeat, they said we have voice contact with the crew.
Around the moon and back, splashdown was only 3 miles off target, a beautiful flight. Command pilot Frank Borman clambered aboard the carrier Yorktown and talked with the crew.
We're just very happy to be here, and we appreciate all your efforts, and I know you had to stay out here over Christmas, and that made it tough on Jim and I always seem to fly in December. We made it home before Christmas in 65. But we can't tell you much how much we really appreciate you being here and how proud it is for us to participate in this event, because thousands of people made this possible, and I guess we're all just part of the group. Thank you very much.
In a year of trials and tribulations, a moment of pleasure for President Lyndon Johnson. He used his hotline for some congratulations.
Now, we all know that you men were supported by an elaborate technical apparatus and by many brilliant and devoted men and women here on the ground. And we salute all of them as we salute you. The first thing I did this morning when the things looked good was to call your boss, Dr. Payne and Jim Webb, and to congratulate them. And then to call your wives in Houston and to express our gratitude to them for providing the strength and the inspiration to you men that will permit you to accomplish this great feat. But we know that all the engineering marvels in the world could not take away one whit of our excitement and admiration for the three of you that were out there in the vastness of space. If I could have exchanged thoughts with you, I was going to ask you whether it felt better coming down or going up. And to have you tell me some of your experiences, because you've seen what man has really never seen before.
The story of Apollo 8, blazing the way for other spacemen who will, perhaps, walk the face of the moon in this year of 1969. 1968 A.D. was also the year of the Alpine crisis. Mickey Mouse celebrated his 40th birthday in 1968. It wasn't exactly a year for laughing, but it wasn't all grim. It could fairly be called a madcap year, the year of the straight face. A Cincinnati judge had just sentenced a university student to 1 day in jail for disorderly conduct when the collegian pulled out a rubber band and shot it at the bench. The judge matter-of-factly sentenced him to an extra 24 hours in the cooler. In Hartford, Connecticut, Judge Francis Quinn hardly cracked a smile when he sentenced a 32-year-old man to 10 days in jail for drunkenness. The defendant was sporting a neon orange shirt emblazoned with the words,
"Here come the judge."
But the Deadpan of the Year award has to go to William Nelson, who paddled his way back home aboard a raft 3 years after he defected to Cuba because, as he put it, "America never did anything for me." Asked why he returned, Nelson solemnly explained, "Cuba didn't do anything for me either." Many Americans have forgotten about the big war scare in the Alps. It was unique in that it did not draw the major power blocs into a confrontation. And if nothing else, it gave those State Department fellows who specialize in crisis management an opportunity to take the day off. It all started when artillery shells began roaring into Liechtenstein from Switzerland. But an all-out war between the Alpine mini-powers was averted by a cool-headed Liechtenstein hotel owner. After escaping a shower of shrapnel, he wisely decided to call up the Swiss. It was a shrewd move, since Liechtenstein is not big enough to field an army of its own. Swiss officials explained that their army was practicing and happened to overshoot. They apologized for the pitiful mistake, and Liechtenstein authorities were satisfied. Thus was stability maintained. In the Alps, they call this the balance of torpor. And good old American humor in 1968 was displayed by a sign left on a motorist's windshield. It read, "I have just run into your car. People have seen me and are watching me write this. They think I am giving you my name and address. They are wrong." 1968 A.D. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to weep and a time to laugh. This is Army Sergeant Ron Nottelson, AFVN Radio News in Saigon.
A.D., a year in the life of man. A time to be born and a time to die. A time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. 1968 A.D., a year in the life of man. 1968 AD was a production of AFVN Radio News. The material for this program was compiled from major American networks, wire services, and military sources. I'm Army Specialist Gary W. Gears speaking.